And tonight is the first lesson of, I think, probably seven of part two, which will start tonight with the early medieval period, 5th and 6th century. In the first part, we establish a definition of anti-Semitism, definition of racism. Then we looked at some biblical accounts of early anti-Semitism, especially in the book of Esther, and how there were parallels between the way Haman was handling the whole situation with the Jewish people and how Nazi Germany and Hitler were also going after the Jews. And then we looked at a lot of the church fathers, the early church fathers, and the later church fathers all the way through the end of the 4th century. Now we're going to get into the Middle Age. So, Middle Ages, actually, let me make sure that we get the PowerPoint going. That would be nice. That's not too nice. There you go. Okay. All right, so a couple of introductory remarks about the Middle Ages. Middle Ages, it is a historical period that followed the Iron Age, beginning in the 5th century and lasting until about the 15th century. So you're looking at 10, like basically 1,000 years of Middle Ages. Many achievements. I mean, the Middle Ages were, you know, we think of the Middle Ages, or as they're also known, the Dark Ages, and we think it was a pretty dark, non-producing period of mankind history, but there's a lot that came out of the Middle Ages, not as much as some other time of history, but we still got many things. Like I've listed a few here. We'll talk in a little bit about the Code of Justinian, some discoveries in the area of mathematics, great names of philosophy like Thomas Aquinas, or painters like Giotto in Italy, the poetry of Dante and Chaucer, travels of Marco Polo, many architectural wonders like the big cathedrals that many of them are still standing in Europe, like the one in Chartres in France, or Notre Dame in Paris. Beautiful, beautiful pieces of architecture. Many things took place in the Middle Ages. The most commonly accepted start date for the Middle Ages is 476, which coincides with the abdication of the last Roman Empire, Roman Emperor, not Empire, that's a typo, last Roman Emperor in the West, Romulus Augustus. The early Middle Ages can also be referred to as the Dark Ages. And indeed, when you look at what happened with the Jewish people in particular, we can see that it was definitely a dark time. It gets darker, believe it or not. It gets worse in the rest of the Middle Ages, throughout up to the end of the Middle Ages, and then it continues. But it starts at that time. It's already a dark time for the Jewish people. As in general rule, the Middle Ages meant one thing for Christians and a completely different thing for Jews. As Europe was striving for unification and as the church was gaining ground, Judaism continued to be a religion apart from and against Christianity. From pope to bishop, from emperor to mob, all across Europe, Jewish people became a sore sight in the eyes of Christians from all walks of life. And, when I say this, Christians from all walks of life, we have to realize, we have to remember, as we go through this period of time, this period of history, that what we call a Christian back then is not what we call a Christian today, okay? The definition of a Christian back then in the Middle Ages is a pagan with no understanding of God or the Bible or spiritual things, brought into a church either by force or by being convinced or indoctrinated or connived into into a church system. So you have a Christian, some of them adhere to Christianity's major tenets of Christianity, but they bring with them a lot of their secular humanism and paganism. So you've got, you know, Christianity back then is far from Orthodox Christianity as we would understand it today. And of course, back then, you couldn't go to a Christian bookstore to see what a commentary would say on the Bible, somebody you could trust, or you just, you know, a pagan Christian, if he decided he was going to go to a church on Sunday or to a cathedral, would just basically get it from the bishop or the priest and then go home and do whatever, if anything, with that until the next time he goes to a service. So you had what? Kind of like, well, yes, but that I didn't want to pick on the Catholics today, but it was a lot worse back then because the education, today it's available. A person within the Catholic Church today who wants to search, who wants to study, has that available to them. They might not, but they have it available to them. Back then, you were at the mercy of the leadership who had an agenda. And so Christians back then, from all walks of life, are basically pagans who have been Christianized. And there's a mix of paganism and Christianity at the very best. So laws continued to be passed beyond the Theodician Code of the third century. And animosity leading to violence was just around the corner. Theological Christian anti-Judaism coupled with pagan anti-Semitism would prove to be an explosive mix for the Jewish communities of Europe. Anti-Judaism in theory became anti-Semitism in practice. This is a shift that you need to understand. It's very important. You know, up to then, there were some cases of physical harm and confiscation of property and all those things, but it was really minor. It was mostly in the writing the laws and the edict of this and the council of that. Up to that point, it was mostly on paper, so to speak, for the majority of the time. Now, all of a sudden, anti-Judaism in theory or theological anti-Judaism becomes physical anti-Semitism. It becomes a reality that's going to be, they're going to put what they have learned, what they have read, what they have heard into practice a lot more in that period of time. And a major influence in the growth of anti-Semitism was brought by the publishing of a new body of laws, not the Theodician Code, which had been the foundation for all this, but the next one is the Justinian Code. So we have that on page 2. The Justinian Code, of course, was put together by Justinian, also known as Justinian the Great. They always like to call themselves the Great or the Only One or the Best or, you know. So I should start giving myself the name like this. You know, like Olivier the Great or Olivier the Best. Yeah, I'm going to have a poll. I'm going to ask people what name they should pick for me. Maybe I shouldn't ask. Olivier. There you go, Olivia Rus. And so he was the emperor of the Roman/Byzantine Empire from 527 to 565. During his reign, Justinian sought to revive the empire's greatness and reconquer the lost western half of the classical Roman Empire. His claim to fame was came through this new body of work, and I've listed them all there. I'm not going to read them all. A bunch of different books that were put together, one of them was the Codex Justinianus, which is the, you know, the Justinian Code, and it was the first one of all the bodies of work that he's put together that was completed in 529. It was compiled in Latin. And it compiled all of the most of the existing imperial laws back to the time of Emperor Hadrian. You're looking at what almost 400 some years prior. While it was what has been recognized as a major accomplishment in its kind, the Justinian Code set in motion many anti-Semitic laws and inspired many more. It used the Codex Theodicianus, the Code of Theodician, and other previous writing as a model. But of the 50 laws, the 50 statutes that were dealing with Jewish people in the Theodician Code, Justinian retained less than half after he dropped all those pertaining to their protection. He's like, oh, we don't need this. We just need to keep the ones that are going to make their life difficult. So the main one, of course, being dropped was the statute that recognized Judaism as a legitimate religion, further legitimizing the abuse and harassment from Christians and pagans alike. Additional restrictions were added, and some of them, the additional restrictions were like, Jews could no longer own Christian slaves. Now, I've been running into a lot of that in all the laws that I looked that were passed against the Jewish people. You keep seeing this recurring theme of Jews cannot own Christian slaves. And I start to wonder, why are they so emphatic about this one? What do you guys think? Why do you think it was such a big deal to the Christian leadership of that time that Jews could not own Christian slaves? I mean, it became even worse to the point of killing them. Right now, it's like you cannot own Christian slaves. You know, return them, free them up. Why would it be a big deal? And then I got to think, back in those days, when you own a slave, it was like a piece of property. You own that person, that person's life, and you did with that person whatever you wish. So a slave on Jewish property would probably end up having to stop working on the Sabbath, to dress somewhat like the Jewish people, eat the same kind of food, listen to the Jewish perspective on things, and Christians were afraid that they were going to lose a lot of their people by letting them being slaves under Jewish people by having them end up converting to Judaism. So that's, I can't guarantee that this is the reason why, but it makes a lot of sense to me, because when you look at the way slaves were treated, they became the property of whoever the master was, and he did whatever he wanted with that slave. So they would end up losing Christians, and of course, for the longest time, the reason why Judaism was a problem is because it was taking, they were afraid it was taking Christians away from the faith, from the truth, so to speak. So then it became, of course, that there was a lot of death involved. But at first, it was let's try to protect Christians from a false religion. That's what the church was thinking. So Jews can no longer own Christian slaves. Jewish property rights were narrowed. Jews were barred from public functions. Jews were barred from the practice of law. And Jews were prevented from testifying against a Christian. They didn't want Jewish people to be exercising law, because then you'd have Jewish people, judges and lawyers, telling Christians what's right and what's wrong. And that just was just too close for comfort. Yeah. Right. Well, there's several stereotypes. The good businessman, the Jewish person going to be in a good businessman, I would actually say it's a fact. It's not a stereotype. The Jewish lawyer, the Jewish doctor, those are stereotypes, but they're based on truth that started at that time. Public office. Right. Right. But the reason why back then you probably didn't have a whole lot of Jewish lawyers and Jewish doctors, but it started in that time where Jewish people could not, and it's going to get worse as we go through the lesson tonight, Jewish people could not own property. They could not buy stock or materials to build something to sell it, or buy stock and be like a grocery store or whatever, and they were forbidden to belong to a guild or to become carpenters or all those things. So they ended up not being able, and it progressively got worse, not being able to do anything that involved material goods. Yet they had to make a living. So what did they do? Well, Jewish people, it's a known fact that Jewish people like to study. They're really serious about their studies. So that's always been that way, reading the Torah and memorizing the Torah. So they took that and then they said, you know what? What can we do to make a living that does not involve anything but knowledge? And the two main one back then was lawyers and doctors. Because a doctor, if you're expelled from France to go to Germany, expelled from Germany to go to Portugal, Portugal to go to Spain, you take it with you. It's knowledge. Back then, you didn't have all the equipment. It was a doctor was mostly looking at somebody and then cutting and poking and saying, okay, we'll try this, we'll try that. So they would take their knowledge of medicine and their knowledge of the law, and they would go from one country to the next. And And that's how the stereotype of a Jewish doctor and a Jewish lawyer became a reality. They were forced to become those two Jewish doctors and lawyers because they could not do much of anything else. The one other thing they could do was money lending, which of course we'll talk about a little later, which was also lent to the stereotype of the greedy Jew. Fascinating story. Push them into it, right? We'll get to it. We'll get to it in another lesson. But the kings of France, the kings of Europe, I should say, all had Jewish doctors, even though they didn't like the Jews. They liked the Jewish doctors because they knew what they were talking about. So, what can I say? Okay, Jews were prevented from testifying against a Christian, of course. And the most damaging change applied to Judaism was the control that Emperor Justinian wanted to exercise over the practice of Judaism. He controlled Christianity, and he wanted to control Judaism the same way. Back then the church and the state were, it was kind of, the lines were being more increasingly blurred, and then the church, the state, it was becoming the same thing. The popes and bishops and the emperors were constantly fighting for power, and greed and corruption was in the way, was in the mix of all that. And Christianity was pretty much controlled by whoever was in power at the time. And they wanted the same with Judaism. And Judaism, of course, back then and before and to this day, has been a religion that sets the people apart based on what God tells the Jewish people early on in Genesis and in Exodus and Deuteronomy, that they're people after his name. They're chosen by God because they're not the best, but they were the fewest. But he said, you know what? I made an oath with your forefathers that I was going to do something with you, and I'm going to do this. I'm going to set you apart. So different garment, different food, different language, different everything. And it's been continuing throughout the centuries to this day. It's amazing that you think that when you look at the Jewish people today, they're continuing to have everything different, and it just gets people upset. They don't like the fact that they're different and that nothing will stop them from being different. Not different just because they think they're better. Just different because that's the way God has asked them to lead their life. So to that end, Justinian wanted to control both Christianity and Judaism. So what he did, he established that Passover would always have to be celebrated before Easter. Well, from a biblical standpoint, there's nothing wrong with that, because Easter is the resurrection Sunday and Passover is the death of Messiah. So from a prophetic standpoint, Passover should happen before Easter. Now, don't ask me to tell you about Easter, because I believe that Easter is not a Christian holiday. It's just a man-made. We talked about being replacing. Sorry. See, candy. There you go. I can always use chocolate. I don't have to wait for Easter. But so he tried to Christianize Judaism, so to speak. Passover would always have to be celebrated before Easter. Synagogue Bible should be in Greek and not Hebrew, which would be a use of the Septuagint, the Old Testament that was translated by 70 rabbis into the Greek. The Mishnah, which is a body of oral laws that have been codified into books, and have been, there's been commentaries on the Mishnah that makes another set of books known as the Gemara, and the Mishnah and the Gemara together make a body of book called the Talmud. Okay, and if you want to know more about which book is what, at the end of the notes for today, you don't have to look at it now, there's a glossary of terms for Jewish books, Jewish literature, so that you won't be too lost. So also, those who don't believe in the resurrection, the last judgment, the existence of angels, then they should be excommunicated and put to death. Nothing big. So a Justinian theological statement to the Jewish community prepared the way for the further criminalization of Judaism, as it stripped Judaism of its legality, leaving the Jewish people with no recourse for the very first time. Abuses became more accepted and more common now that punishment and discipline had become virtually non-existent. Whatever happened to the Jewish people at the hands of the peasants and villagers, it was not really being punished. It was just like too many things, too many too many things were happening, and in the scope of the search for power in the Middle Ages, the emperors and the generals and the, and all those, you know, they didn't care. Yes. It has a?
Has it passed?
No, 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 no.
And if it did, what would all the Jewish families up in San Francisco?
What does it have to do with this right now?
It's like another law.
Oh, of course, yeah. From the perspective of another law, yes, we yeah, I was going to touch on that. Well, yes, if it passes, I don't think it's going to pass. It's too far-fetched. But it shows a world agenda which was the same as the Middle Ages. You basically take rights one after the other. I used the example in the earlier today in the class about what happened during Hitler. My father's dad was told one day that he was supposed to take his bicycle to the city hall or the police station in Paris. So all the Jews took their bicycles because they were being confiscated. Why? Because first they wanted to make sure that the Jews would not be able to move around as fast as they wanted to. They would have to do everything on foot. See, if they take the metro in Paris, like my mother told me the stories, they had to take the very last car on the metro where all the Jews with the yellow star would sit in the last car. So you would control that, but when they walked in the street, they would walk, no bicycles, of course, no gas, no cars, but no bicycles, so confiscate all the bicycles to cripple their moving around. And then the next thing, they're staying home, they're still connected, even though not with one another, through the radio. So the next thing after the bicycle being confiscated, they pass a new law that say all Jews must bring their radio unit to the police station. And so they all, and then the Jews thinking, like, well, we're just French citizens, we, you know, we're abide with the laws. So they took their, you know, my dad told me, my dad just went to the police station and he took his radio unit, so they couldn't hear the Allies and, you know, and Charles de Gaulle in England telling what's going on and when they're going to come back and everything. So it's the same thing, taking, you know, one thing at a time, you know, crippling the Jewish people, and we're going to see more of that happening here in the Middle Ages. It's just, you know, it's a repeat. It was a repeat 70 years ago, and we're starting to see this again now to cripple the Jews. You know, it's first, you know, you see those things where you always see, first you try to change the way people do things. Then if you can't change the way people do things, the next step is just push them out. You know, the history of the Jews is like, let's try to convert them, or you know, we don't like the way you do things, so you can change. If that doesn't work, well, we don't like the way you do things. If you can't change, we're going to kick you out. And then eventually, we just don't like you, period. We're going to kill you. That's what happened up to the Holocaust. So we see a little bit of that starting here, where first it was a theological debate where we don't like what you think. We don't like the way you do things, and all those writings happen, and all those books and those codes, and then it starts getting implemented, and of course probably taken out of context by the people that were uneducated, but nobody was really checking on it. They were letting it happen. And as a result, unfortunately, you know, as much we've already done that on the PowerPoint here, as much as I can appreciate teaching this class presenting the Jewish community of the days, or almost throughout the whole history of the Jewish people, presenting them as the victims, they were also not squeaky clean. Now, none of their responses were they were not preemptive strikes like, well, you know, we hate the Christians, and there were a few of those, but very minor. We hate the Christians, we're going to kill them. There was very little of that. But as a response to what was happening against the Jewish people, we saw some damage done by Jews against Christians. In Jewish response here, third point, we see frustrated and crippled by the new laws and ensuing abuse, the Jewish communities around decided to fight back. The reason for fighting back outside of self-defense was to maintain Jewish autonomy and legal status in a world exponentially becoming Christianized. And again, when I say Christianized, remember, Christianized, Christian slash pagan mix, okay? So it makes for a very uncontrollable, explosive mix here. The results were not always as desired. As a matter of fact, just about every time a Jewish community would fight back, the Christian or pagans or the authorities or a mix of everything would severely punish them beyond what could be deemed necessary. Yet, several things took place from the Jewish community. In Caesarea in 556, Christians were killed and churches destroyed. In Antioch in 598, Christians were killed and bodies burned. And all this as a response to what was done against the Jewish people. Jerusalem 614, alongside the Persians under King Khosrew II of Persia, 30,000 Christians perished. The joint venture of the Jews and the Persians to retain Jerusalem in 614 under the leadership of Benjamin of Tiberias led to the destruction of many Christian homes. They managed to keep Jerusalem out of the hands of Emperor Heraclius, but he retook Jerusalem in 628, only 14 years later. Frustrated with the Persians' lack of commitment to fight back, Jewish people changed sides, probably not the best idea, and joined Heraclius in his campaign to retake Jerusalem. They were more concerned about making sure that they would retain Jerusalem than anything else, so they made some wrong moves here. This unlikely alliance did not stop Heraclius from punishing the Jews, and with the blessing of Patriarch Modestus, in an attempt to unify the empire, to decree that all Jews had to be baptized, which was a next big campaign against the Jews, and it started in about, you know, early 600, forced conversion and forced baptism. So this is the next thing we see here. We're going to look at that period, you know, the early 600. We see the East and the West. The East was forced baptism and conversion. The West was a little more tolerance. The East, we see three groups of Jewish people. The rather new practice of forced baptism introduced a rather tragic new element in already weakening Judeo-Christian relations. Emperor Heraclius was not the first one to impose baptism on the Jewish people in the East. His motives were vastly political, yet Christianity was so closely meshed with the state that Jewish unbelief was considered a grave crime against the state. So, basically, being Jewish and practicing Judaism at any level. And remember, back then, there was no such thing as Orthodox, conservative, and Reformed Jews. Okay, if you were Jewish, you were Orthodox. End of story. Okay, unless you didn't know you were Jewish, you were adopted or something, and then whatever. But if you were Jewish, you were a practicing Jew. Because being Jewish back then meant living in a Jewish community, and that's all they knew. So Orthodox, conservative, and Reform, and everything in between is an American invention. It doesn't even exist in Europe to this day. You only have two kinds of Jews in Europe. You have those who practice and those who don't. You don't have anything in between. It kind of exists the same way, but they're not categorized like they are in America. Anyway, back to this. What? Israel, there's more of a variety like America, because a lot of the Jewish people in Israel also come from, they've immigrated and they brought with them the different, but it's a little different too. You know, Israel is a country that closes on Shabbat. That's nowhere else in the world. So even if you're not a practicing Jew, culturally speaking, the whole country closes down, shuts down on Friday night. So it's part of the culture more than anywhere else in the world. Heraclius' attempt to unify the empire through Jewish conversions to Christianity did not yield the result he hoped. Out of his effort, three groups of Jewish people emerged. We have those three groups here, the steadfast Jews, the lukewarm Jews, and the crypto-Jews. Steadfast Jews prepared to fight unto death rather than convert. You had Jews that would say, I will never convert to Christianity. You can kill me. You can torture me. I will never deny the faith. And you had a lot of those. Then you had the lukewarm Jews that were like, maybe a little less religious than the others. But they said like, hey, you know what? I can take advantage of Christians and Christianity. I can, there's something in it for me that, I can gain from it, so they compromised. And then you have crypto Jews pretending to be Christians, but still Jews at home. So, and in lukewarm Jews, really, also in that group, you also have some who actually converted, a very small minority converted to Christianity. But again, back then, what was really Christianity? It was pretty much the Catholic Church, so it's different from what we understand as being Christianity. There was really not much of anything when it came to Messianic Jews back then. It didn't really exist in the Middle Ages. Crypto-Jews, they're also known as, it's an early type of false Jewish converts, later commonly known as Moranos or Conversos of Portugal and Spain during the Inquisition, and they became an abomination to the church and a shame to the synagogue. Occasionally, a Christian leader would loosen the grip on the Jewish community and even treat them somewhat fairly. So crypto-Jews, Moranos or Conversos are Jewish people that appear to have converted to Christianity, and they become a sore sight in the synagogue. They're rejected because of that, because of their compromise. But behind closed doors, they still light the candles for Shabbat, and they practice. They keep kosher, and they practice. They follow all the Jewish holidays. And we see a lot stronger community of conversos or Moranos during the Inquisition, where it was conversion or death was a lot stronger than it was right then. So, in light of all this, we do have a few people that are actually somewhat friendly or not as bad to the Jewish people. Such a man was Pope Gregory, 540-604, who felt that conversion and baptism should not be forced upon anybody, but it should be a choice based on conviction. And you know what? He's right. You think about it. Conversion and baptism, I mean, infant baptism is not biblical. Okay, when you read the Bible, baptism is an act you want to tell people that you have been buried in Messiah and raised in Messiah. The eunuch on the road, when he meets Philip, he said, okay, I don't understand the Bible. Tell me what this passage is telling me. And he heard the passage, he found Messiah, and he said, you know what? There's a body of water right here. What prevents me from being immersed right there on the spot? So that's baptism. That's something you make on your own volition. It's a choice we make. Cannot do it when you're an infant. And conversion is the same thing. We choose. You cannot be converted by force. Well, the only exception, if you use a PC, I can force you to convert to the Mac. But that's a different story. This is not a religious thing. So, anyway, Pope Gregory, even though he was no great friend of the Jews, was more lenient and was hoping that they would see the benefit of converting to Christianity. In a sense, it was similar to the approach that Luther had. Now, we'll have probably one session, or we'll spend a little bit of time on Luther, because he contributed to the faith, but he also contributed to a lot of anti-Semitism after some of his writings. But Luther, like Pope Gregory, was hoping that, hey, you know what? And he took even a step further. You know, no church, no priest, no pope. It's just the Bible and me and a direct relationship with the God of the universe. And he thought, if that's the case, the Jews, we're going to take all of the church bad rep away. The Jews are going to see, like, yeah, Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, all the messianic prophecies, they're going to want it. And the Jews came back and said, you know what? This is a great step in the right direction. Take Jesus out of the equation, and you got us. And of course, Luther said, can't do that. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, okay? So there's some parallel here. The parallel is that this Pope, who was more lenient with the Jews, he thought that maybe if I let them choose on their own, they'll see the truth in it. But at the same time, he also did and said things that were not really helping. For instance, he wrote a letter to Ricared, which is the thing in on top of page 5 here. Ricared was a king of the Visigoths. He's a king of Spain, and he wrote a letter where to compliment him, to praise him for not accepting a bribe from a Jewish person, from some group of Jews. And he said this: furthermore, I must tell you that I have been led to praise God, the more for your work by what I have learned from the report of my most beloved son Probinus, the presbyter, namely that your excellency, having issued a certain ordinance against the perfidy of the Jews, those to whom it related attempted to bend the rectitude of your mind by offering a sum of money, which your excellency scorned, and seeking to satisfy the judgment of Almighty God, preferred innocence to gold. So, Gregory also chose one of the Sundays after Pentecost as the day to celebrate Titus's burning of the city of Jerusalem, quoting Luke 19:41-47, in which Yeshua foretold to defeat the defeat of the Jews at the hand of their enemies. And in, also he wrote an exposition on the book of Job, in Moralia Job, where he described Jews as the limbs of the devil militating against the Christian servants of Christ. By doing all this, he started, Pope Gregory, started to legitimize the demonization of the Jewish people. It was not much later that we started to see Jewish people described in drawings and paintings as demons with horns and pointy tails, a stigma that would endure centuries across continents and that continues to curse the Jewish people in modern times, especially within radical Muslim circles. You see Jews with horns and tails in cartoons today. You saw them. They originated in the early Middle Ages. Never stopped. It never stopped. It kept getting worse over the centuries. And as a matter of fact, there was a statue by Michelangelo, a statue of Moses. I don't know if you've ever seen Moses sitting on his big chair. And if you look at that statue, you Google Moses by Michelangelo, and you see a picture of Moses, a beautiful statue. He's got horns. He's got two horns. Most people don't even notice it. He's got two horns on his head. And this was actually, the two horns were added because it was a mistranslation of the word from the Hebrew to the Latin, rays of lights, which in the word was almost the same. It went from rays of lights to little horns. Michelangelo, Moses. And you'll see the statue of Moses sitting on his chair and with a big beard and everything. It's a beautiful statue. It's gorgeous. It's got horns. Yeah, it would never take it out. It's just strange. I think it's in either Florence or Rome. I'm pretty sure it's in Florence. But anyway, so we have this demonization of the Jewish people, and that started with this, you know, of course, those writings. So even though Gregory was not an enforcer of many of those laws against the Jewish people, he was not exactly a good friend of the Jews either. The Second Council of Nicaea in 787 declared that all baptized Jews who secretly continued to practice Judaism should no longer be admitted in the church and administer the holy sacraments should be allowed to practice Judaism freely. Well, that in itself is a good thing. Okay? It's like, well, if you're not serious about Christianity, you shouldn't come to the church. Well, I mean, it's okay. That's good, but it's not the only thing they did. They went after them and forced them. So it was like forcing them to do it, but then if they don't do it, they should be able to practice Judaism, but they would not let them practice Judaism because it became illegal. So it was like a catch-22. You know, you must do this. If you don't do it with your heart, just go back to Judaism, which you cannot practice anyway because it's become illegal. So it was like, you know, damn if you do, damn if you don't. The church made some early attempts at letting the Jewish people practice Judaism, but the medieval desire of the leaders and the masses to bring religious and cultural unity influenced many to continue forced conversions and baptism, leading to its apex under King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain during the 15th century. That's when you have the Inquisition, and at that time of history. We'll get there probably in 2014 at the rate we're going. But we're not there yet. The West, limited tolerance. It was a little better in the West. Jewish people who lived in the West benefited from a different group of leaders coming from those who invaded the Roman Empire, like the Goths and the Franks and the Lombards. These leaders, for the most part, were following the Theodician Code and made Jewish life more tolerable. Jews were considered Roman citizens and thus left alone, at the very least in principle, if not always in reality. Theodoric, 454-562, applied Roman law literally to all, and in many ways that would benefit the Jewish people, actually. He was even able to punish a Catholic mob that had burned a synagogue and force them to rebuild it. He was definitely one of the few who had a balanced and fair approach to all, including the Jews. Theodoric was eventually replaced by Pope Gregory, that we just talked about, who, even though was not a great friend of the Jews, made some minor attempts at treating them somewhat fairly. His devotion to the Theodician Code and its proper practice was also counterbalanced by his genuine desire to see Jewish people convert to Christianity, a Christianity that by then had been infiltrated by, and corrupted by a myriad of man-made Catholic traditions. Nevertheless, he was somewhat of a breath of fresh air for the Jewish people, who would soon again be submerged in a sea of hatred at the hands of Christians, kings, and pagan masses. Actually, Pope Gregory, even had a fairly decent understanding of the teachings of Paul. He was a very important figure in history for both Christians and Jews, and as abrasive as he was about the Jews in his sermons, he still held to a Pauline theology that saw the Jewish people as part of God's plan, and his letters to the clergy were a lot more in line with a true biblical love of Israel and the Jewish people. And so it was a struggle between what he actually believed and what he did or allowed to be done, but he was a more subtle, one of the more subtle and more friendly pope with the Jewish people. He had a tremendous authority and was able to establish a foundation later used for many of the policies of the Catholic Church regarding the Jewish people, which ended up not being too good to this day. No, but I can tell you. I mean, since the first pope, I can find out. Yeah, he was. I know the time. He was, you know, in the late 400, the early 500. But I don't know which pope it was. There were so many of them. Did you know that some of the popes actually had kids? There's some popes had illegitimate children. That's, I know, it's just amazing. So, his influence, Pope Gregory, his influence on Christian policy permeated the entire period of the Middle Ages, and if not always in daily practice, at the very least in theory. Now we're going to take a quick look at Spain. Spain is a very interesting country when it comes to the Jewish people. It was okay for a while, up to the early Middle Ages. Then it got not too good for the Jewish people. Then for a long period of time, for about 700 years, it was the best time for Jews ever. It was the golden age of Spain, believe it or not, under Muslim rule. And then it got really bad when the Muslim got kicked out. And when Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, you know, started the Inquisition, and it never got better. And Spain to this day is a very anti-Semitic country. Probably not as bad as Poland, anti-Semitic. Probably not as bad as Poland, but Spain is really, really nasty when it comes to Jewish people in the 21st century right now. Really bad, really bad. So let's take a look at a couple of the key kings of Spain. First one that we're going to talk about is King Ricared. That's the king that Pope Gregory wrote a letter to. He was the Visigoth, which is a branch out from the Ostrogoth, the Visigoth. It's a branch of the Goth leaders. He was the leader of Hispania. Hispania was the name of Spain in the Middle Ages, from 586 to 601. Prior to that period, Spain had been a rather welcoming haven for the Jewish community, who had strived there demographically and had acquired substantial wealth in the process. If there is a place for the Jewish people that is welcoming, they're going to start moving in. They're going to start coming, because it's just not everywhere. So pretty quickly, you get, that's why we have so many Jews in America today. You know, because after the war.
So many Hispanics in California.
I'm not going to comment on that. So, yeah, so if a place is welcoming to the Jewish people, they're going to come and they're going to establish synagogues, they're going to build synagogues and schools, and they're going to flourish. And so this is what happened. The Theodician Code had little or no effect on Spanish Jews for a while, until Ricard converted to Christianity. Then the zeal comes in. You know, I'm a Christian now. We got to make sure those Jews don't infiltrate or compromise the faith. So now he becomes more legalistic than the true Christians before him. As his kingdom, the church and the people were starting to mesh, the Jews slowly became the usual stumbling block to kingdom / church growth. The Third Council of Toledo in 589, mind you, we have 28 councils in Toledo over a period of almost 100 years, I think. So they had a lot of gatherings to discuss church matters heresy and whatnot. The Third Council of Toledo in 589 continued to delegitimize Judaism as King Ricard established more laws, some of them garnering him praise from Pope Gregory. Amongst these laws were Jews can no longer own Christian slaves. No more Christian slaves. Then Jews can no longer marry Christian women. So that must be Jewish men can no longer marry Christian women. Now Jewish women were still allowed to marry Christian men or pagan. I don't know why. Not that they would, but I don't know why. It was just one way, not the other. I haven't found any information on that. And Jews can no longer hold public office. Any public office you would hold back then would put you in a position of authority, and they just could not have a Jewish person in a position of authority. It's just like, picture what's going to happen. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. When you start having some influential Muslims in places of authority in America, okay? You get the Sharianization of America, okay? It's coming, okay? It's coming. We know about it better than most because we see the signs, and we tell other people, and they think we're just conspiracy theorists. But it's coming. It's coming. Every day you see more of it. So they did not want... Now, this is the same concept, not necessarily bad. In the case of Sharia law, it's bad. In the case of Jewish people, it was probably not a bad idea because they're very good business people. They're very organized, and they would be... They were great lawyers, great doctors, but somehow the general consensus was we don't want them to rule us. So let's ban them from any public office. Ricard was his laws were loosely enforced at best, and the laws were loosely enforced under Ricard. But the Jewish community did not really suffer until the advent of and reign of the next king, Sisebut. I do my best with those names. Okay, I'm sorry. Sisebut, king what? Sisebut, king of the Visigoths, 612-621. Sisebut. I know, it's just those names, I'm sorry. Sisebut was determined to eradicate the remains of the Byzantine Empire within Spain, and having been made aware of Jewish dealings with the East, he decided that, you know what, if I'm going to eradicate the Byzantine Empire, I also have to get rid of the Jewish people once and for all, because they were helping them in some way. So, it's almost like, the First Crusades of 1096, the Christian soldiers were going to fight the Muslims in the Holy Land, but on their way they found nothing better to do but to kill and rape and maim the Jewish people of the villages of Europe throughout all the way down to Jerusalem. So here it's like, okay, the Jews had some dealing with the people from the Byzantine Empire, so let's get rid of the Jews as well. He managed to enforce, take the D there, out to enforce, not enforced, some of Ricard laws. Now we're talking about Sisebut now, and also instituted the first major campaign of forced conversion and baptism. Before that, they were doing it back and forth, but there was nothing organized as a major campaign. He was the first one to do that. Jews were faced with two choices: immersion, baptism, or exile. And one king replaced another as the Jewish people saw their rights progressively being taken from them. The church was struggling with all the ramifications of conversion and baptism, forced or voluntary. But this is a big mess here. That's the next king here. I don't want to jump here. We see the forced conversion and forced Because it was forced, it was something that was, it became its uncontrollable monster, like we see the three groups of Jewish people, the ones that would use the Christians, the ones that would die for the faith, and the ones that would go like, okay, I convert, and then they go home, close the shutters, light the candles, and pray for Shabbat. You have those three groups of Jews. It became an uncontrollable group of people for the church, and this made... this was a big mess for them to reckon with, the ramifications of conversion and baptism. But mind you, at that time you still had two choices, immersion or baptism or exile. When you get down to the 1500, to the Inquisition, the two choices were immersion or death. Okay, now we're moving towards... you know, a greater harm of the Jewish people. When you can still get out, go to another country, you have a hope of saving your life. Mind you, the history of the Jews of Europe in the Middle Ages all the way to the 1500 or 1800, you see them, you know, going from one country to the next. They get in, they settle, and then when they're settled, the leaders of the country say, you know what, we don't want you anymore, so leave your stuff behind, get out. So that's a recurring story of the Jewish people. But still, we have immersion or exile. We're still not at the place yet in history when it was convert or die. Of course. So then the next king, here's another name for you, Recesquinth. Eventually King Recesquinth, 649-672, denounced Judaism before the 8th Council of Toledo. He was quoted saying that Judaism was abominable, detestable, and a pollution. He campaigned for Jewish blasphemers to be forced to sign an oath making the daily practice of the Jewish faith impossible. Violators were either stoned to death or burned at the stake. He also forbade Christians to help Jews in any way and forced Jews to celebrate all Jewish and Christian holidays in the presence of a bishop. Yet the Spanish persecution of the Jews and of the early and Middle Ages had not reached its worst until the next king, King Erwig. So Recesquinth was the one quoted amongst other things. He said Judaism was abominable, detestable, and a pollution. Okay, he further contributed to the delegitimization of Judaism. Yes.
Did the mass of people basically go along with him?
Yeah, they were uneducated, and an uneducated group of people. If the leadership gives you a reason to go after people that are responsible for... and we're going to see this, a lot more of this, in a few centuries. Because we're going to have the poisoning of the wells of Europe. Who's responsible? The Jews. Well, not the poisoning of the wells. The Black Plague. Who's responsible? The Jews, because they poisoned the wells of Europe. We're going to have the killing of many Jews because they use Christian blood to make matzah for Passover, the blood libel. We're going to have that. We're going to have the Jewish people at the 12th, I don't know what number it is, but the Lateran Council of 1215, they're going to pass a law that Jews have to wear special garments to be recognized from a distance so that people can see them coming on the byways and avoid them. But instead of avoiding them, of course, as soon as you see a Jew coming, you do whatever you want with them. So all those things are going to become more of a reality with the masses, uneducated masses, that only know what they're being told by their leaders. And of course, you take sinners and human nature, and you mix all that together, and you get this this killing of innocent people. Exceptions? I'm sure there were exceptions. Just like in France, in the 1400s, you had a group of true Bible believing Christian known. I'm not sure about the time, the date, but known as the Huguenots. And the Huguenots it was about that time, I think, the Huguenots were the ancestors of the Bible-believing evangelicals. They were true Bible-believing Christians, and I don't know if you've heard of a small town in France of Le Chambon-sur-Lignon, where the pastor of the town during the Holocaust ended up hiding either 500 or 5,000, I think it's 500 Jews, in his village, and the Germans knew it, but they couldn't find them. They knew that he was doing it, but it's a great book that was written about him, and he even ended up in the camps and came back. And that pastor was a descendant of the Huguenots. And when the lady in the village, it's a great story in the 1940s, was interviewed later on when they wrote the book and made a movie about it, she was asked, why did you guys do all this? It was an old lady who lived through it. She said, it was the most natural thing to do. She read the Bible, she understood the Bible, and to her it was like, I'm not sure if the movie was with, I think it was a documentary, so it probably is not. You know, but it's a great book. I forgot the title of the book. I have it at home. It's a great book to read. So yes, there were exceptions, but they were probably not the norm. They were probably not the norm because people did not read their Bible the way, you know, until Martin Luther, Christianity was Catholicism. And Catholicism was not in favor of the Jews, except for some of the popes. But, you know, what are the peasants in the field and in the small villages going to find? How are they going to learn from the Pope exactly how to treat the Jews according to what Paul wrote in the Bible? I mean, the first Bible was printed under Gutenberg, and we're not even there yet. So there was very limited knowledge. Exactly. So now we're under King Erwig. Erwig, and 680-687, he passed another 28 laws to further alienate Jewish life in Spain. Jews are ordered to accept baptism. They have no choice. I don't know if they already had one before, but right now they're ordered to accept baptism. Jewish convert could not travel without a permit from a priest. Now controlling of the Jewish life beyond making Judaism illegal. Now we're starting to control, just like the idea of the Second World War, take their bicycles away, take their radios away, take their money away. You know, now you start seeing controlling. If a Jewish man wanted to travel from one place to another for to see family member or to conduct some business, he would have to go to the priest of his local village or area and say, or bishop, and say, I need a permit. And the priest would go like, I don't think so. Then he was stuck. Couldn't do business, couldn't go to, you know, any family event or funeral or wedding or going to a school, whatever they wanted to do. He couldn't do it because he would have to get a permit from a priest. So now we're starting to see, and it's going to grow from this point, we see more and more laws to reduce mobility, just not make Judaism illegal, but reduce mobility and the rights of the Jewish people to basically make them into people that eventually the apex of this whole thing is to turn them into subhuman, vermin, subrace of Nazi Germany of the Holocaust. Yes. Sometimes they were, sometimes they were not. Remember, for the most part, they didn't. For the most part, they
so
didn't.
Even if they followed all the laws, you were still
burning. In essence, basically, if they converted to Judaism, if they converted to Christianity, some did, and there was a small amount that would comply with the authorities and with the church, but there was a very small amount. And for many, even if you were, if you had been a Jew converted to Christianity, for many, for the masses, you were still Jewish. And it, you know, you're fair game. So Jews were ordered to accept baptism, don't travel without a permit from a priest. Jews were forced to listen to Christian sermons. We're going to see a lot more of that later on in history when there are Jewish Christian gathering between bishops and rabbis. This is known as disputation. When a rabbi and a bishop get together, and it would usually be in a cathedral or a church, it would never be in a synagogue, and it would be for the purpose of converting the Jewish man, the Jewish rabbi, and his following community to Christianity. So they were like comparing theological perspective on God and religion. Of course, very seldom did the Jew ever win. But they were called disputations. And of course, also, I guess to humiliate them, Jews were forced to eat all kinds of meat. King Erwig was joined by successors and other kings who added some of those laws. Jews had to surrender all property that they had acquired from Christians. So basically, they acquired property, they bought something, they bought a field from a Christian, well, you got to give it back, and you don't get your money back. Oh, of course. And what? Right, exactly. Jewish holidays were abolished and made illegal. So basically, you know, you could not celebrate Hanukkah or Passover. All that is abolished. So 325 Council of Nicaea, Passover is taken off the charts. It can no longer be Christians up to 325 AD celebrated Passover, just like Jews celebrated Passover. At the Council of Nicaea, if you remember, that's when the Christians are told no longer will you celebrate Passover. Now, around the late 600, 500 years later, you have, 300 years later, you have not just the Christians who no longer can relate, no longer want to celebrate Passover. Now the Jews are told your very own holiday you can no longer celebrate. So in 300 years we went from just the Christians departing from that to the Jews are now forbidden to do it themselves. And all Jewish children, 7 and older, were taken from their families and raised as Christians in an effort to basically, in many cases, if they were not killing Jewish people quite yet, they were trying to nip Judaism in the bud. If we take the kids away and they're young, we can just mold them into believing that Christianity is what it's all about, and they'll become Christians. They'll never know they were Jewish. Some of them probably didn't even know they were Jewish. They were taken away by force, and then you lose all generations of Jewish people. So yet God continued to make the Jewish people flourish, kept them going and going and going, and you still have Jewish people today. That's why I think it's Mark Twain who said, if you don't believe in God, just look at the Jew. Something like that. Conclusion. You thought I would never get to that word. Conclusion. In 711, after its last king, King Wisita, all those names, I'm sorry, I can't handle it. King Wisita, 702-709, the Visigoth Empire collapsed under the pressure of Islam from North Africa. Muslim soldiers in the Tariq bin Ziyad and 7,000 troops landed in Gibraltar and were able to take over Spain. Hardly conceivable in our 21st century that the 8th century Spain invasion by Islam had received some help from the Jewish community, who perceived their brief and limited partnership with Islam as an opportunity to combat a common enemy. Following would be almost 7 centuries known as the Golden Age of Spain. When you have a common enemy, you get Jewish people, you get Jews and Muslims holding hands and going like, "Let's fight the Christians who are persecuting us." And then all of a sudden, you got Jews and Muslims going like, "You know what? Let's put our differences aside. We've got a goal that we can achieve together better than if we fight on the way to that goal." So now you've got Jews and Muslims fighting the Christians, and it's, to an extent, going to work. The question we can ask ourselves is, comparing the 8th century to the 21st century, why would Muslims back then want to really work with the Jews? And why would they get along? We're not looking at couple of decades. We're looking at 6, 7 to 8 centuries of growth and getting along and flourishing of Jewish people and even Christians to a certain extent under Muslim rule, especially in Spain and out of Spain to Portugal and Italy and France. Why was that? I think, I'm still looking into it, but I think it has something to do with the fact that this was the first time in the history of Islam that Muslims actually started invasion somewhere and taken over, and it was successful. They were not rejected yet. They got rejected and defeated later by Charles Martel out of France, and then later on in the 1600 out of Vienna. But that was the first time that they would actually go into Europe, and they were not stopped. And in the Muslim faith, once you've been into a land, it is yours. If you're defeated later and push back, it's still yours and you must go back under jihad to gain it again. So as far as the Muslims are concerned, they lost in the 800 and they lost again in the 1600, but it's always been theirs because they gained it once. And it's never going to be anybody else again. So they will fight jihad until they get all of Europe again, like they lost it last time in 1652, something like, I forgot the exact date. The date of their defeat in Vienna in the 1600 was the same date. It was September 11 of 16 something. I forgot the exact year, but it was September 11. That is correct. Thanks for bringing that back. So, the church and the state had morphed into an entity that repudiated the Jews on all fronts. They, the Jews, started to migrate from one European country to the next, finding temporary solace across one border, only to be soon expelled and sent onto their continual journey as wandering Jews. We are going to see that the Jewish people, I've said all this already on the screen. We're going to see that the Jewish people are going to have a little bit of respite under Spain under Islamic rule, but there's still going to be some laws being passed, and it's going to continue. This is the time where it's going to slow down for the Jewish people, and some great Jewish rabbis like Maimonides, I forgot the other name right now, it escapes me, but some great rich Jewish rabbis, Jewish philosophers, Jewish poets, a lot of Jewish, great Jewish people came out of that time and contributed greatly to mankind in general. Next week, we're going to talk about the Jews of France. So we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about the Carolingian Empire, and we'll talk about Charlemagne. Yeah, you've heard of Charlemagne, right? He was a great friend of the Jews. French kids hate his guts because he invented school. That's the little story. We sing songs about Charlemagne when we were a little kid in school about how much we hate him because he invented school, and we don't like that. But he was a friend of the Jews. That's enough for me.